It's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is going to be an empowering hour. I will promise you that before this hour is out, you will have insights and an awareness on issues at a depth that the mainstream and alternative media does not dare touch. Today, a continuation of our ongoing dialogue on an issue, the issue of why we have taken our democracy for granted, why we are not actively participating, with the exception of small groups of people. But as a whole, Americans seem to be indifferent about the takeover of the United States by the most powerful. Professor Henry Giroux, Truth Out. A commentary today from Chris Hedges, The Maimed. Why do I believe this is important to share today? Because we keep hearing about Afghanistan being Obama's good war. Is it? Chris Hedges will share a different perspective on the good war, the victims. I'll be sharing an issue with you today from Sarah G. of Green Med Info. This was something originally discovered by Dr. Samuel Epstein, who I'm now co-authoring a book with on cancer. Dr. Epstein, an MD, PhD, found that mammograms actually increase cancer in women. He was attacked for doing this, but because of his scientific background, because of his ability to provide facts, they stayed away from him, because every debate he was in, he won. He even testified before Congress, and it was one of the most muted discussions ever. They were almost afraid of opening doors by asking him questions. Why is it then, when all these athletes are wearing pink as breast cancer awareness, they're not realizing that the effect is more women will be treated with drugs, including tamoxifen, that do not help them? So today, from our issue column, mammograms are linked to an epidemic of misdiagnosed cancers. For those of you who are working on a grassroots level in California and about to work on a grassroots level in all the other states to get on the ballots propositions similar to Proposition 37, the labeling of genetically engineered food, your chief opponent has been a Dr. Henry Miller. He has been their number one spokesperson. Today, I take on Dr. Henry Miller. There will be no personal attacks. I don't encourage it or allow it. Instead, I will simply look at his background and what he's come out on publicly. Was he right to support Big Tobacco? Was he right to want to reintroduce the toxic pesticide DDT? Was he right to aid Exxon's efforts to undercut the reality of climate change? All of this will be discussed, because this is the man who actually said the Japanese exposed to radiation from Fukushima, quote, could actually have benefited from it. Really, Dr. Miller? Well, we'll have something to share that will not be in common. So for all of you who are finding every time you turn around, you're hearing Dr. Miller being quoted and interviewed, I'll give you some tools to push back with in California. As you see, we take on the hard issues, and we take it on with scholarship and research that will stand scrutiny. And my standard is, will the information presented withstand cross-examination in a court of law? Let us begin. We all know that sugar is not good for us. No one ever says sugar's like an orange is great. Medical News Today took an in-depth look at sugar, and research from American University Center for Behavioral Neuroscience and also published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition found that sugar can harm the brain and it actually encourages overeating. Let me quote this. Diets high in saturated fat and refined sugar lead people on the path to obesity while also changing their brains, which may provoke overconsumption of those same foods and make losing weight very challenging. Quote, this is a vicious cycle that may explain why obesity is so difficult to overcome. You've seen the commercial for Lay's potato chips? And they point out the challenge obese individuals face in their slogan, bet you can't just eat one, describing how hard it is to say no to high-calorie foods. Well, now the latest research indicates that overweight people and obese kids are more likely to overeat even when they're not hungry. How's that? Because their brains are being adversely affected. There was Purdue University publishing in Physiology and Behavior Peer Review Journal where it explained how the hippocampus, an area of the brain which controls memory and learning, is adversely affected by sugars in the diet. So the takeaway message is this. When you eat something, you may be allergic to it. That'll cause weight gain, even if the calories are not excessive. It also impairs the immune system. Hence, being overweight makes you more susceptible to all forms of infection. Also, when you start to eat fatty foods, trans fat foods like French fries and pizzas, and sugary foods, you actually create a condition similar to taking heroin or cocaine or opium or morphine or oxycodone, some of the other chemicals. What happens is you actually create an opiate addictive reaction in the brain. That's why going off caffeine, sugar, junk food, all has similar effects. The withdrawal becomes so painful and uncomfortable, people go back to what they were addicted to. So add sugar right in there with cocaine and heroin. It is today, if it were created for the first time, all sugar would be banned, all processed sugar. Now that leads me to my second issue. Most of the people I counsel are adults. Many are in their 20s and 30s because they're sick and they don't know why. You have to go back to the teens to see this. This is the latest study, and it deals with how many young people in the United States are affected by liver disease. Now, what does the liver do? It's an organ, and it's one of the largest organs in the body, and it filters. It does two things. It metabolizes, and, for example, it'll take vitamin B6 that you take as a vitamin, and it'll convert that into pyridoxal 5-phosphate, which is what the body uses. It'll take vitamin C and convert that into ascorbate that the cell uses. So it's always doing this conversion. But the major thing the liver does, it takes toxins out of the body. It collects toxins, breaks them down, conjugates them, and expels them, generally through the feces. That's when it's working well. And the number one nutrient to help facilitate all this detoxification is glutamine and glutathione we have to have an abundance amount, but we don't because of our diet. We simply have more toxins going into the body than what the body can process. So we have an overload of toxins in the liver. This leads me to this, and this was at the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. Quote, 10% of all teenagers have liver disease. Now think of that for a moment. We have 80 million people in the United States who are under the age of 18, and a lot of those are teenagers. So we're dealing with somewhere in the neighborhood of about 5 to 6 million teenagers. That's a tremendous amount. And so what we have is we have a disease that can end up killing them. It used to be very rare. It is called a non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And why do we get it? The fatter you are, the more likely you are to get it. The more obese, definitely you're in line to get it. So here's what Dr. Marilyn Voss, Emory University professor, says, quote, the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is in teens is actually growing faster than teen obesity rates. This is a great alarm, end quote. So what's causing the liver of teens to get so corrupted? I have one major culprit I'm going to put up there. Fructose corn syrup, the high fructose corn syrup, it really destroys the liver where it is completely metabolized. Now, for perspective, only 20% of glucose, on the other hand, is metabolized in your liver. And fructose also results in storing 300% more fat than glucose, making kids fatter to boot. So every time they have a soft drink or any beverage, that's where you get most of your high fructose corn syrup. You're 300% more likely to get fat. But then you'll hear this argument from these scientists working for the food industry saying, but come on, an apple's got fructose in it. They are correct. An apple does have fructose. But when it's present in fruits and vegetables, it's in its natural, unaltered state, which means that the fructose in an apple is very small. It's released very slowly. It's released during optimal digestion. Therefore, it doesn't spike your blood sugar level and keeps the glycemic level low. Therefore, a diabetic could easily have an apple and not have a problem with glucose. On the other hand, when you have a beverage and it has the high fructose corn syrup, that's going immediately into your blood. There's no digestion required, and it spikes it. And so what we have is we have children consuming a great deal of high fructose corn syrup. We're destroying their bodies, destroying their livers. And why? Keep in mind that that high incidence of liver, fatty liver disease can lead to diabetes, hepatitis, cancer, and cirrhosis of the liver. And a diseased liver means you're not going to be able to digest your food. You won't be able to metabolize hormones. You will not be able to regulate your blood sugar. You will not be able to eliminate toxins, and you won't be able to store vitamin A as a healthy liver would. So let's just put all this together. And what we have is we are sacrificing the lives of our children, their health, their future vitality, with indifference and hubris on the part of the parents who are acting in an irresponsible manner, by major media corporations that are accepting the advertising because it gives them profits, by the manufacturer because no one's complaining that is important to them, and politicians who accept money or positions of consulting later after their careers are over. And you can always see how someone is voting is related to their future employment, because they're not coming down on the side of the consumer. Today I'm filming in Chicago. In fact, right after this show, I have to go back to filming part two. I'm filming a pediatrician, a professor, a woman, for a new film I have on vaccines coming out in the spring. I have not had anyone in science or medicine that I've interviewed that has as much knowledge and scholarship on just eviscerating. This woman's like a master samurai. She just leaves nothing in front of her. I mean, every topic I give her, she takes on, and she says that the doctors are responsible because they're irresponsible. They could find the truth. They don't want the truth. Pediatricians in particular. And then you start realizing how lucrative pediatrics is. The sicker the kids, more sick kids, more money. It's hard to be cynical, but you have to look at how many people are profiting from your kid being exposed to an ad, believing the ad, participating in the product, getting sick. We adapt to that sickness. We buy them bigger clothes. We encourage them. We don't say no. We're afraid that they'll yell at us or not love us or not respect us. So gaining the respect of the kids frequently means you no longer have a legitimate role as a caregiver to provide a healthy, happy, but disciplined environment. Discipline simply does not exist today in the United States. Intellectual discipline is gone. Emotional and spiritual discipline is non-existent, especially in the religious communities and their churches and synagogues and mosques. It just doesn't exist. You have strictures, codes, conduct, and rituals but we don't see a manifestation of spiritual discipline. If we did, then all these religious congregations and their leaders would be in the streets protesting, in front of the White House protesting, in front of government buildings protesting, in front of television stations protesting. But we don't see any of that. We're confused about everything in our society. So, look, an altar. What if we made it as a metaphor? Every day, parents dutifully bring their child to an altar. And there in front of them are the priest, the doctor smiling with a solid gold stethoscope, the pediatrician. We're going to give your kid all these vaccines. Are they needed? If I say they're needed, they're needed. Do you have any science? We don't need science. We only need the certainty of our beliefs. But is there any science behind that? You're questioning me now. Sorry, and you back away. The government, we wouldn't allow this doctor to give these vaccines, nor would we allow these people to feed your kid these foods if we knew that they were toxic or bad. So obviously, the FDA, the USDA, the National Institutes of Health, the National Cancer Institute, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, we're supporting eating these sugar-frosted flakes, these soft drinks. We're supportive of all this. I see. And besides that, the politicians, 1970s pimps, except they don't look it. I just wish there was a law that when you become a politician, you must dress up in pimp gear, have the pimp mobile, and surround yourself with all the pimp memorabilia. Then at least we'd be able to see who they are. But they stand there, pathologically dysfunctional, sociopaths, all of them are, and trying to preen as if somehow this legislation is needed, these rules are needed, this bureaucracy is necessary. None of that is true. So they protect the system. The people from the New York Times, the ultimate pimps, show up. And they say, well, of course the official version is right. We only report the official version of everything. That's what makes us objective. No, the official version is wrong. It's historically been wrong. And the people who give you the historical version are liars. So all you're doing is manifesting a protection of the liars. You never put forward the alternative position. You've never been ahead of the curve on anything. You wait till the beast is down, then you go and kick it by doing the story. Why don't you try kicking something in the face like a giant bureaucracy while it could fight back? Then you'll show me you deserve to be called a journalist. But you don't fight unless someone's already dead. Then you jump on this corpse and you get your Pulitzer. Shame on you, New York Times. But then again, shame on all the journalists. They're such cowards. And so all this while, your kid's saying, but I want this. I want my cell phone. I want my computer. I don't care who you are. You're a hotel. You're a limousine service. You know, you're an ATM machine. Now shut up and take care of me. You said I was perfect, precious, beautiful. Well, I am. So reward me. I'm here on the altar. Crazy metaphor, isn't it? Now tell me what part of that's not true. Let's go on. Low-level curcumin. Why is curcumin important? Because it's one of the most single, perfect, diverse nutrients you can take. Here's why. Researchers at Ohio State University looked at it because they had heard and saw the scientific research with over 1,500 articles in peer-reviewed literature about how important it was. The question was, would it be as important at a low level as at a high level? They published in Journal of Nutrition Journal. They investigated the possible health benefits of small amounts, and they found that it was exceptional, especially if you're a middle-aged person. Quote, this study demonstrated that in apparently healthy individuals, a relatively low doses of a specific curcumin preparation can exert a variety of health-promoting effects. Specifically, in the present study, curcumin lowered triglyceride readings but did not affect various types of cholesterol. All right? So the good news is this yellow turmeric spice that's in curry, when we take it at a low dose, it will help us, but when we take it a high dose, it just knocks disease out of the ballpark. So I suggest don't take a low dose of 50 milligrams, 500 milligrams, then you're going to see magnificent results. And finally, from New Zealand, a University of Auckland study, and also verified independently, University of Oslo study, 2 to 3 kiwis a day could keep cancer at bay by helping to repair damaged DNA. So they're actually prescribing kiwi in tandem with dietary advice and improved physical activity, and that led to a significant repair of damaged DNA. I'm unaware of any other study that's ever done this. Quote, prescription of daily kiwi fruit may provide a sustainable population intervention that could reduce some of the risks associated with cancer, said Dr. Elaine Rush. Now, studies at Thame University have reported that kiwi has a natural laxative effect and could help combat constipation. And other studies show that kiwi can reduce blood clotting by thinning the blood and reduce stroke and help deep vein thrombosis be prevented. So, my suggestion, start juicing kiwi, skin and all. Great way to get it into your health shake. Quote, kiwis showed an improvability of the DNA to repair itself after the peroxide challenge, end quote. So all good news, all about things we can do. I'm Gary Nall. Time for us to go to a call to action. Right now in the state of California, there are tens of thousands of local activists and consumers who are just concerned they don't want to eat genetically engineered food if they can help it. The trouble is they can't differentiate now because there's no labeling required, as there is in over 40 other countries of the world. So they have managed to get onto the ballot, a referendum for November 6th, and it's called Proposition 37. My role, doing our show on our sister station, KPFK, for nearly 30 years, 6 hours every week, is to provide the tools for them to legitimately be concerned enough and motivated enough to go out and get others to say, let's vote yes on the 37 labeled genetically engineered food. What they're finding is all over the state, between $35 to $40 million has been spent by ads and spokespersons and articles to say no. And the leading person is a Dr. Henry Miller. You'll see him everywhere. And he's good at arbitrating. He's good on their side. Give the man credit. But then you have to see, is he really unbiased? Because no one out there is saying, Dr. Miller, are you really unbiased on this issue? Because they're letting him on the air as if he is an independent scientist. All right, let's just take a look at this. I want to share some information from Zach Caldvere. Here's what we now know about Dr. Miller. First and foremost, he has stated repeatedly in the ads, quote, Dr. Henry Miller, medical doctor, Stanford University. That's what you see in all the ads. It's saying no to Proposition 37. Okay. What is it, Dr. Henry Miller, Stanford University? The answer is no. What has now been discovered is that he is affiliated with the Hoover Institute, a right-wing think tank at the university. In other words, he works on the Stanford campus as a corporate propagandist. He is not a professor at Stanford University. So that's a big deflation right there. So what has happened is when we started promoting this, we managed to get this ad yanked. And an attorney sent a letter to Stanford pointing out that the university's affiliation was being used as a political advertising campaign in violation of university policy. So Stanford University has demanded that the campaign remove the campus from the ad's background. But from my perspective, that's not the most disturbing aspect of Dr. Miller's sordid career. Here's what he has also been. Dr. Miller was a spokesperson for Big Tobacco, where he personally helped Philip Morris discredit the links between tobacco products and cancer and heart disease. So as long as Dr. Miller was campaigning on behalf of Philip Morris and tobacco, people continued to smoke, believing that it was safe and did not contribute to their heart disease or cancer. How many people then, the question is, which we will never know, ended up developing cancer or heart disease or emphysema, trusting Dr. Miller. Dr. Miller advocated for the reintroduction of the toxic pesticide DDT, which we all know was banned in the United States and has been linked to preterm birth and fertility impairment in women, toxic effects upon the immune system, and all over the world we have examples of the high toxicity levels of DDT and persistence in the environment 25 years after it was banned. The credit for banning DDT sits squarely and solely with the woman who wrote the most important initial book on the environment ever, Rachel Carson, a marine biologist. I helped on that campaign as I was, at that time, a best-selling author, and I was also the editor of Caveat Emptor, Consumer Beware. But it was Rachel Carson who was responsible. She was the first to bring us this information. She was the one who championed it. She was the one by herself who took a beating by the pharmaceutical industry, condemning her, criticizing her, attacking her and the government, standing on the side of the pharmaceutical industries and the makers of DDT. But here's Dr. Miller wanting us to reintroduce it. It was also Dr. Miller who sided with Exxon in Exxon's efforts to downplay climate change. Dr. Miller also was attacking the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's efforts to ensure proper vetting and testing of new drugs safety while urging it to outsource more of its function to private industries. Dr. Miller claimed the Japanese exposed to radiation at Fukushima, quote, could actually have benefited from it. Now, Miller's not the only dubious character the number of the Proposition 37 has brought forth. But his one-man tour must be completely dismissed. Let me give you something very specific. I've seen the ads where he claims repeatedly that, quote, the World Health Organization, the American Medical Association, the National Academy of Sciences, and other respected medical and health organizations all conclude that genetically engineered foods are safe, end quote. The trouble is, Dr. Miller, you should know, none of what you just said is true. Truth. The National Academy of Sciences report concluded that products of genetic engineering technology, quote, from their official position, carry the potential for introducing unintended compositional changes that may have adverse effects on human health, end quote. The American Medical Association has adopted a position calling for mandatory safety assessments of genetically engineered foods. Never been done. And the World Health Organization's, the United Nations Standard Group on Foods, the Codex Alimentarius, which sets the global science-based standards on food policy issues, states that mandatory safety studies should be required, but they have not been. So, within simply one sentence, you made three preposterous assertions, none of which are true. In fact, within the past few weeks alone, independent peer review studies have raised even more troubling questions about the impact of genetically modified foods on our environment and the risk to our health. But Monsanto has ponied up $7.2 million, DuPont $4.9 million, and now they're telling us Agent Orange and DDT are safe. Not true. So for all of our listeners in California, please join the thousands within the labor and the women and the health movement to encourage people to say no, Dr. Miller, and yes on Proposition 37. Vote yes, because we want to see all of our food that's genetically engineered labeled. Then you have the consumer having a freedom of choice. Watch how few people select genetically engineered food after that. Also, for all of you in California, we have already sent you three chapters of my new documentary on genetic engineering. You can go to Roy of Hollywood to download those. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with our issues and commentary. Please stay with us. welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. As you have heard from previous commentaries, I'm concerned that in the United States today, where there are those in this audience and certainly other audiences, I would commend Alex Jones's audience. I would certainly commend Jesse Venturi and all of his efforts at encouraging people to just simply take a look at what is happening to our freedoms and to those in power and how they're using their power and all the rules and laws and executive orders. How do those impact us, for the better or worse? The harsh realities of a society defined by the imperatives of punishment and cruelty and militarism and secrecy and exclusion can also be seen in the emergence of a growing rhetoric of insult and humiliation and slander. Teachers are referred to as welfare queens by right-wing pundits, and conservative radio host Rush Limbaugh claimed that Michael J. Fox was faking the symptoms of Parkinson's disease when he appeared in a political ad for Democrat Claire McCaskill. And the public is routinely treated to racist comments and slurs and insults about Barack Obama by hosts of shock jocks and politicians and even one federal judge. Poverty is not only seen as a personal failing, it has become the object of abuse and fear and loathing. Poor people, rather than poverty, are now the problem, because the poor, as right-wing ideologues never fail to remind us, are lazy. And after all, how could they be poor since they own TVs and cell phones? Racism and cruelty and insults and the discourse of humiliation are now packaged in a mindless rhetoric that is as unapologetic as it is ruthless, and has become the new lingua fraca, a public exchange. I challenge Bill O'Reilly. You act as if anyone who has an independent thought, a progressive thought, is a pinhead, someone we should not take seriously, someone who does not speak in the common vernacular, someone who is incapable of framing an issue outside of the rigid ideological guidelines of your extremely biased or Rush Limbaugh's biased or Sean Hannity or that absolutely mutant intellect that seems to be as pervasive as a genital herpes on all the media, self-promoting herself as if she knows what she's talking about. And it's unfortunate that people have not brought on people to debate her and called her. And you call yourself what? And you condemn those of us who actually think? Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney echoed the harshness of the new lingua franca of cruelty when asked recently about the government's responsibility to 50 million Americans who don't have health insurance. Incredibly, Romney said they already have access to health care because they can go to a hospital emergency room. In response, a New York Times editorial pointed out that emergency room care, quote, is the most expensive and least effective way to providing care, end quote. Of course, these are his remarks, rarely challenged by his followers. Indifferent to the public health needs of the poor and the middle class, Romney also conveniently forgets that, as indicated at in the Harvard University study, quote, more than 62% of all personal bankruptcies are caused by the cost of overwhelming medical expenses. So the new lingua fraca of cruelty and its politics of disposability are on full display here. To paraphrase Hannah Arendt, we live in a time when revenge has become the cure-all for most of our social and economic ills. And yet neither the right nor the left has the courage to ask, why does it cost $1,400 to spend a miserable night just sleeping in a bed in a hospital with no food, no care, no nursing, nothing, just the cost of a bed? The argument is about who should pay for that. Well, why don't you get at the profiteers? Why don't you ask in a society that is supposed to be so abundant in its privileges and its capacity to help others find solutions? Why don't we have a double system, a two system of helping those who want the most expensive medical procedures, the most expensive hospital treatment with suites can have it? You want a surgeon that will charge you $100,000 to repair your heart, or a psychiatrist that will charge you $1,000 to counsel you or give you drugs? You should have that right. But should we not also have the right to have a single-payer system for those who choose it, and to have non-commercial, charity hospitals that also have the finest care available, the finest technology. The difference is they are not being able to profit from it, so therefore they get it at its real cost. So we are hiding from the profit motive in our entire healthcare system. But this is part of neoliberalism. And this is also, in my opinion, the retreat from ethical considerations and all dialoguing. Not only does neoliberal rationality believe in the ability of markets to solve all problems, it also removes economics and markets from ethical considerations. Economic growth rather than social needs drives politics. Long-term investments are replaced by short-term gains and profits, while compassion is viewed as a weakness. And progressive public values are scorned because they subordinate market considerations to the common good. As the language of privatization and deregulation and commodification replaces the discourse of social responsibility, all things public, including public schools, libraries, transportation systems, public parks and rivers and lakes, crucial infrastructures and public services are viewed either as a drain on the market or as a pathology. Greed is now championed because it allegedly drives innovation and creates jobs. Show me the proof. Massive disparities in income and wealth are celebrated as a justification for embracing a survival of the fittest ethic and paying homage to a ruthless mode of unbridled individualism. Ah, there you can show me the proof. It's on television, The Survivalist, and all the other foolish, existential drivel in extreme exhibitionism. Morality in this instance becomes empty, strips of all and any obligation to the other, as if there is no other sacred in life. And what you have is not sacred. It is proprietary. How else to explain Romney's gaffe caught on video, in which he derided 47% of the people who will vote for the president no matter what? There was more than just that slip at work here. When some have called, quote, the killing of the American dream, or simply a cynical political admission by Romney that some voting blocks do not matter. Romney's comments about those 47% of adult Americans who don't pay income taxes for one reason or another, whom he describes as, quote, people who believe that they are Americans who don't pay income taxes are victims, who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it, end quote, makes clear that a politics of disposability is central to the extreme right-wing philosophy of those who control the Congress and are vying for the presidency. Paul Krugman is on target in arguing that in spite of a massive suffering caused by the economic recession, a recession that produced, quote, once unthinkable levels of economic distress, there is growing evidence that our governing elite just don't care. I disagree. I believe they do care deeply about themselves and their families, but no one else. Mr. Romney, Mr. President Obama, you have not ventured where I have. You'd be afraid to. First, there's no monitors, so you have someone think for you, and you simply articulate like a ventriloquist and his dummy. I speak with Americans at all levels of life, including senior citizens, who do not want to be handed anything, who have spent their entire life working nobly and honestly and with ethics and decency and morality, and who in the end, when it comes to their retiring years, that they could live through their Social Security payments and pensions that they had worked for, they had earned, that was theirs, and now it's gone. Frequently from outsourced jobs that disposed of them, like you would shred paper, we shred humans. 30 million of them. They do not ask people to give them free food. I've seen cupboards with nothing but cat food and people severely malnourished. They didn't want to beg, and they were willing to work, but no one was going to hire them. Why don't you look in the face of real Americans without anyone present except you and them and listen to what they have to say? It might recalibrate both of your warped perspectives. the not-so-hidden order politics underlying the Second Gilded Age and its heartless version of economic Darwinism is that some populations, primarily the elderly, the young, the unemployed, the immigrants, and the poor white minorities of color, now constitute a form of human waste and excess. You now treat all of these as if they're nothing more than excrement to be put into some unseen septic system. The politics of disposability delineates these populations as unworthy of investment or of sharing in the rights, benefits, and protections of a substantive democracy. What is particularly disturbing is how little opposition among those in America who view themselves consciously as patriots have of how we are disposing of so many people by making them irrelevant. Perhaps more than anything else, this signals the presence of a rising authoritarianism in the United States. Left unchecked, economic Darwinism will not only destroy the social fabric and undermine democracy, it will ensure the marginalization and eventual elimination of these intellectuals who do stand. If all you can do when someone shares a thought is to disdain them for having the imagination, the insight, the intellect, and the character to have created that thought, you can agree or disagree with the thought, but you don't even want to have the people allowed to have the thought. And that is as true of Obama as it is of Romney and the right. So what exactly then will you do? You will eliminate the intellectuals and the progressives who are willing to fight for public values and rights and spaces and institutions not wedded to the logic of privatization, commodification, deregulation, militarization, and hypermasculinity and ruthlessness, which the two of you are twiddly-dee and twiddly-do. You are equally combative and equally prepared to compromise every value that is essential, and you engage in the dialogue of ego, competitive struggle in which only the fittest will survive. Clearly, this new politics of disposability and culture of cruelty will wreak destruction in ways not yet imaginable, despite the horrific outcomes of the economic and financial crisis brought on by economic Darwinism. All evidence suggests a new reality is unfolding, one that is characterized by a deeply rooted crisis of education, agency, and social responsibility. In conclusion, under such circumstances, to paraphrase C. Wright Mills, we are seeing the breakdown of democracy, the disappearance of critical intellectual discourse, and the collapse of those public spheres which offer a sense of critical agency and social imagination. Since the 1970s, we have witnessed the forces of market fundamentalism attempt to strip education of its public values, critical content, and civil responsibilities as part of a broader goal to create new subjects wedded to the logic of privatization. So now you praise efficiency, consumerism, and the destruction of the social state. Today, neoliberalism's ascendancy has made the educational force of culture toxic, while educational institutions, whether in public or higher education, have all but transformed from promoting the public good to affirming private interest. Encountering an onslaught of neoliberal ideology from all sides, it becomes increasingly difficult for the larger public to hold on to ideas that affirm social justice and community and those public values central to the cultural and political life of an aspiring democracy. Within both formal education and the educational force of the broader cultural apparatus, with its networks of knowledge production in the old and the new media, we are witnessing the emergence of a dominance, a powerful and ruthless market-driven notions of politics, governance, teaching, learning, freedom, agencies, and responsibility. Such modes of education do not foster a sense of organized responsibility central to a healthy democracy. Instead, they foster what I have referred to in the past as a sense of organized irresponsibility, a practice that underlies the economic Darwinism and public power and corruption at the heart of both the current recession and virtually all, with the exception of the independent, American body politic. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Now we go to the section of our program, the Talk Back segment, your opportunity to call in and share your comments and points of view on anything you would like. Our number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And while we're getting ready to take your calls here, let me just share. I'll be up in Seattle later this week filming, Vancouver, and California. So it's a busy week. But we've got to get it, got to get out there, got to share the information, the resources to get people involved. From the Green Med Info, a very interesting piece on mammograms. I did my first show challenging the efficacy and safety of mammograms in 1977. But unfortunately today, most people still believe that a mammogram or a diagnosis of a precancerous or cancerous condition should be met with immediate treatment, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. Well, for most of the 20th century, mastectomy was the first-line treatment for ductal carcinoma in situ. And younger patients were more likely to undergo the procedure even after lumpectomy, and radiotherapy were shown to be at least as effective for invasive cancer as mastectomy. But that hasn't changed anything. 26% of patients are still receiving mastectomy. Total nonsense. Shouldn't be. The most common scenario today is following the diagnosis of a ductal carcinoma in situ is for the oncologist to recommend lumpectomy followed by radiation and hormone suppressive therapy such as tamoxifen. The problem here is that women are not being educated about the nature of this ductal condition or the concept of non-progressive breast cancers. There is still the black and white perception out there that you either have cancer or you do not have cancer. In fact, in a poll on the ductal sarcoma and pseudo awareness, 94% of American women doubted even the possibility of non-progressive breast cancers. In other words, these women had no understanding of the nature of the condition. And why would they? Major authorities frame the precancerous condition, implying its inevitable transformation into cancer, when the standard of care is to suggest the same types of treatment used to treat invasive cancer. Very few women are provided with the information needed to make an informed decision. Early detection through X-ray mammography has been the clarion call for breast cancer awareness campaigns for a quarter of a century now. However, very little progress has been made in making the public aware about the crucial difference between non-malignant lesions and tumors and invasive or non-invasive cancer detected through the technology. And when all forms of breast cancer pathology are looked at in the aggregate, irrespective of their relative risks for harm, disease of the breast takes on the appearance of a monolithic entity that you either have or don't have. They call it breast cancer. The concept of a breast cancer that has no symptoms, which cannot be diagnosed through manual palpitation of the breast and does not become invasive in the vast majority of cases, might sound unbelievable to most women. However, there does exist a rather mysterious clinical anomaly known as ductal carcinoma in situ, which is in fact one of the most commonly misdiagnosed and unnecessary treated forms of breast cancer today. What women fail to understand because their physician did not know better or have not taken the care to explain to them is that they have a choice when diagnosed with this condition. Rather than succumb to aggressive treatment with surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, women can choose watchful waiting. Better yet, a radical lifestyle change can be focused on eliminating exposure to chemicals and radiation, as well as improved exercise and nutrition. And this choice is not being made in any of these movements. Between 30 and 50% of new breast cancer diagnoses obtained through X-ray mammography screenings are classified as ductal carcinoma. And ductal carcinoma refers to the abnormal growth of cells within the milk ducts of the breast, forming a calcified lesion 1 to 1.5 centimeters in diameter. That's very small. And it's considered non-invasive or stage zero breast cancer. And many experts I've spoken to believe it should be completely reclassified as non-cancerous condition. And because this non-ductal is almost invariably asymptomatic and has no palpable lesions, it could not be known as a clinically relevant entity were it not for the use of X-ray diagnostic technology. Indeed, it was not until the development and widespread applications of mammograms in the early 1980s as a central push behind the National Breast Cancer Awareness Campaigns that rates of the ductal sarcomas diagnosis began to expand to their present-day epidemic proportions. It is no wonder, therefore, that the United States, which has one of the highest X-ray mammogram rates in the world, also has the highest level of ductal sarcoma in the world. And it's estimated that 500,000 women are living with the diagnosis. Well, proponents of breast screenings claim that they are saving lives through the early detection and treatments of the ductal sarcoma, regarding it as a potential life-threatening condition. And distinct from invasive cancers. They view it as a precancer and argue that because it could cause harm, if left untreated, it should be treated in the same aggressive way as invasive cancer. The problem with this approach is that while the rate at which ductal sarcomas progress to invasive cancer is still unknown, the weight of evidence indicates there is significantly less than 50%, perhaps as low as 2% that would. Indeed, the 10-year survival rates of patients with ductal sarcoma is 98%. Post-treatment speaks volumes to the relative benign nature of the condition. Another study found that the 40-year follow-up period, 40% of ductal sarcoma lesions still had no signs of invasiveness. Adding even more uncertainty, another study showed that coexisting ductal sarcoma independently predicts lower tumor aggressiveness in node-positive luminal breast cancer, indicating its possibly protective role. So you've been oversold by all these organizations, the ones that give you the mammograms, the ones that give you the tamoxifen, the ones that want to immediately operate. We need sanity brought to the field. Chris from New Jersey. Chris, your turn.
Thank you for all your work. I'm really calling unrelated to today's topic. I'm really just calling about the general state of affairs in the country and about last week's QE3. And just if no one's really talking about this, and this is really my only suggestion with people who are fed up with the direction this country's going in. In 6 months, we have to pay our taxes. Let's not. Because the only way to hit these people is in their wallets. And QE3 is really just another bank bailout. So...
Well, I appreciate that. Chris, unfortunately, I just looked at the clock and we're out of time. I want to thank you for being conscious enough and courageous enough to stand up and offer some pushback. I believe that what you should do is join with other individuals to see what are the basis of your being able to succeed in your personal efforts and what other ways could we stop. My belief is if you really want to hurt these people, hurt them where they can't fight back. Stop buying anything they sell. Hit them in the economic wallet. That's what they understand. Chris, thank you. For all of you who have joined us on PFW in Washington, KPFK in Los Angeles, BAI in New York, Progressive Radio Network, I thank you for listening. For those of you who want to continue listening, you can go to the telephone at 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or progressiveradionetwork.com. Let's continue now and say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have a very interesting email here from San Bernardino, California. But before I share that, I just want to let you know that yesterday I met with a woman who was diagnosed with ductal cancer in situ, the DCIS. And they wanted to do a mastectomy. She's one of your listeners. She opted for a lumpectomy. They wanted to take out several lymph nodes. She said, do not take any lymph nodes out. Just take out the mass. They did. They found that the mass was negative for cancer. But do you want to know, Gary, they encouraged her, they put the fear of God in her to have radiation therapy just to be sure, and they wanted to put her on tamoxifen for 5 years. That is how distorted their belief system is. It's totally negative cancer.
It is perverse. It is completely perverse. But these are the ways that people who have absolute unrivaled power do. And that's why we should not be supporting Breast Cancer Awareness Week. Now, 3 weeks ago in California, in Los Angeles, there was a massive run for the cure. And to their credit, a whole group of women took 300 copies of Preventing and Reversing Breast Cancer Naturally to the event and spoke with women that there is another approach that should be understood. And they were well received by many women, and they gave out all the copies of the video. But it's a long process to reverse brain control, and that's what you really have.
And you know that a man had to invent the mammogram, because you don't see any tests for men to put their testicles between two ice-cold bookends and have them smashed together with pressure on each side. You know, I always tell people, I know a man invented this. I had one mammogram in my life. It was the most uncomfortable and humiliating experience I've ever had, and I've had thermographies ever since then. And, you know, the insurance companies don't even cover thermographies. It's out of pocket. But
do you think the author 50 Shades of Grey wrote the book because of the pain inflicted from a mammogram? And many men would like that?
So. You see? That's what it's all about.
What's your
anyway, I got a beautiful email here from Michael from San Bernardino. He said, I began listening to you when I lived in New York City, and I've been here in California for 7.5 years. I download every show and listen in the evening. The LA Times, he says, just broke a story where they just voted in favor of labeling the GMO foods. He says, I attended your rally and lecture in Los Angeles where you gave us a very convincing argument on why we should tell at least 10 people to support Proposition 37, vote yes for labeling GMOs. He says, I also hear you on KPFK saying the same thing. Since you have the largest audience, an internet audience, and the largest progressive audience in America, I want you to know that your efforts are paying off. Congratulations, you're making an enormous difference whether you are aware of it or not.
Well, that's nice. I appreciate him spreading the word. It's all about people talking with people. So good. I'm happy about that.
Yes.
Next question.
Okay, I have something from here from Sari. She says, I don't know if this will get to you. She says, but my father drives a cab in New York City, and he told me that 7 months ago you were in his cab. The fare was $5, and you gave him $20. You told him to donate the next rider a free ride until it was all used up. And he asked you why, and you said, because there are some of us who believe that we're still connected by a spiritual thread, and you left. That had a profound effect on him. In his 25 years of driving a cab, that had never happened. He knew who you were. He saw you on PBS and listened to you on the radio. And this woman said, I just wanted to let you know that little things do make a big difference.
I always do that. Every time I get in a cab, I always think, what would it mean for the next person to get in a cab and the driver says, your cab ride has been paid for. By whom? Don't know. Just a person. Why? I wish there was a little quote from George Bernard Shaw that could go on to remind us every day. He said, the worst sin towards our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent to them.
Yes.
That's the essence of inhumanity. So reverse it. Connect yourself with other people so you're not indifferent. You appreciate them, even if they're a stranger. And, well, we're out of time. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time.